Can you describe the school, what it looked like?
We went through several phases of school structure, I suppose is the better word. We started out teaching literally in the open air, sitting on mats. We'd use a couple of ground sheets just sitting on rubble. Quite often we'd have one of the children sitting at the edge on snake watch because the children got quite worried about the snakes that were there. So, you know, sometimes the children just watching out. And it literally was sitting on rubble, so it was quite uncomfortable sometimes. Also very, very exposed to the sun during the summer. It was quite unpleasant. Sometimes we had umbrellas, sometimes we didn't. Sometimes when it rained, we'd get wet and we'd work as long as we could because for the children it was their only interaction some days. So we'd work as long as we could, but it was very, very hit and miss. So we progressed from working outside to taking the loan of a tent. But again, it wasn't ideal. It used to get flooded when the rain came. And then we progressed from that to a structure that was put up by essentially hammering pieces of scaffolding into the ground, stretching a cover ground sheet around the outside, and then putting some corrugated plastic on the top. And that provided a structure that had three classrooms.
Did you have any training or preparation for this kind of teaching?
No, just the standard training that we've had as school teachers. By and large, that was sufficient because children are children wherever you find them. Some of the circumstances were a little bit more challenging, and we did have days where we'd be teaching in tents that would be collapsing and, you know, struggling to remember how to tie a reef knot to keep the tent up or find a bit of a tree to replace a broken pole. But by and large, the teaching side is teaching is teaching.
When you're teaching in this context, what are your goals? What are you trying to achieve? And how is it different from a normal school?
I think what we're trying to achieve each time is to get the children to the age-related expectations. So if you're working with a 10-year-old, it's about trying to get that 10-year-old in terms of reading, writing, maths to the levels that we would expect of a 10-year-old. Broadly, international standards are broadly comparable. I mean, there are some differences, but it's trying to get that standard that we would recognise here in England and that qualifications like International Baccalaureate also recognise.
How many children were there and what was the age range?
There was about 200 children in the camp and we would take about 100 daily. We were teaching mainly 5 to 11-year-olds, but the older girls really found it difficult getting out of the camp. And some of that was about the fact that they were on baby duty a lot of the time. Some of it was about the fact that parents were very protective of the children. So the teenage girls would hang around the camp, and as they heard what we were doing and had confidence in it, they would then start presenting themselves for lessons. You know, one day I walked in and found a group of 6, 7, 8-year-olds with a couple of 17-year-olds sitting there alongside them.
Were there any surprises for you apart from the teenage girls?
Yeah, I think every day had at least one surprise, because sometimes the children would turn up with injuries and they'd be saying things like, you know, look, my arm is bleeding. And you'd be saying, yeah, it's bleeding. Right, let's stop the lesson. Let's get some bandages out. Sometimes the children were hungry or they didn't have clothing, or sometimes there'd be a crisis in the camp. I remember one day we had a thunderstorm and the children thought ISIS were attacking again because they'd fled a village where they'd been attacked and the thunder sounded like gunfire. And we just had pandemonium, children running everywhere. We had to stop lessons for the rest of the day because they were just too traumatised by it.
And the curriculum, were you using the UNICEF curriculum? Can you tell us about that?
We had a very, very simple curriculum, actually. We essentially focused on English and maths. You might say, why focus on English when the children mostly didn't speak any English? But it was the one request that we consistently got from every family is to do English. They wanted English more than maths, they wanted English more than their own language. And I think that came as a little bit of a surprise to me about how valued English was. So we taught a lot of English, and part of the reason for that as well is that in the camps, English is the lingua franca of the international aid community. So in terms of what we taught the children with English, we would often start with emergency phrases. So we would do parts of the body so that they could explain if they're injured, you know, my arm hurts or my eye hurts. We would work through items of clothing and items of food so they could explain if they needed something. A bit of basic vocabulary again so they can explain if there's a problem. And then the focus was on the English for maths, because to teach maths, you need vocabulary like equals and plus and take away. So we do that kind of vocabulary. And I think what we found is that trying to get the English and maths moving, we often didn't have time to get to the broader UNICEF curriculum, where there were the lessons on well-being and hygiene and health. Sometimes we did that sort of stuff, but actually we would try and get other groups to do it, because having professional teachers present, it didn't seem like the best use of the teachers when we could do the English and the maths, which the other groups couldn't do, but they could do the health and hygiene as well as us. So I think it was better to ask those groups to do that kind of stuff.
Was the UNICEF curriculum helpful or useful?
I think as a vision, it was logical and coherent, but I think it's a little bit like what you find in any normal school, that you give teachers a curriculum and the first thing that they're going to do is start adapting it and modifying it, because every group of children is a little bit different. And even with something like the national curriculum, I'd be surprised if any school in the UK ever teaches just the national curriculum, you know, the whole national curriculum and nothing but the national curriculum. You know, normally there's a little bit of modification.
What did the children themselves want to learn?
English, very much English, English, English. And maths, actually. One of the things that really surprised me is that when we started out teaching maths, initially we would get a response, no maths, no maths, just English. But after a little bit of time, we actually had girls turning up saying, maths, please maths, because some of the girls had never learnt any maths at all. And I remember a group of 15-year-old girls who had never, ever done any maths in their life. And my first lesson with them was trying to convey the concept of taking away. And I wasn't entirely successful, because some of the girls grasped it straight away. You know, hold your fingers up, here's five fingers, and you know, look, I'm taking these two away, how many fingers are left? And actually, the girls just struggled with the concepts. They couldn't conceptualise taking away. I've never encountered anything quite like it. And it may be that some of the children had special needs. I think definitely some of them had special needs. But I think also what it showed me is that children learn things at particular points in their life, and learning those fundamental concepts like adding and taking away, if you haven't got it early, sometimes it takes a lot of trouble to acquire it later. But I think the teenage girls in particular, they came to really enjoy the maths, and that they would come and ask for it. And you know, there's one girl that I worked with that had never done any before, and in about a week she did as much as we would normally do in a month. You know, phenomenally able young lady.
Are there things that you know now, having done more of it, that you didn't know at the time?
Yes, I think one of the things that we came to realise is that teaching reading from a phonics series doesn't work in an ESOL context, because the phonics series, the kind of words that are used for phonics, are not the high frequency words that you would be introduced to when you're first learning the English language. You'd often get words included because of their sounds, like you'd get kangaroo because you get a nice roo sound, which is great. If you're a natural speaker of the language, then you approach school with quite a large vocabulary. But if you are a Kurdish or Arab child who has had a little bit of English, but not a lot of English, or you've been out of school for 3 or 4 years, as many of these children had, then you're approaching the lessons with very, very little English. And the English that the children need is really the high frequency words. So the kind of language that you would use to start reading and writing in English is very, very different than the words that you would learn, you know, like kangaroo. You're not going to use that generally every day. I think generally the resources were entirely inappropriate because they generally consisted of what we could scavenge from other sources. So we would have books that were literally the remains at the back of cupboards from schools in either England, France or Germany. At one point I remember having a set of books in front of me where I had a set of atlases, and I had a French one, a German one and an English one. And you know, poor old teachers having to translate Alemania. Well, you know, which country is that? that's Germany. Now, that's the French word for Germany. Now, here I've got the German word for Germany. And actually, it's quite a strain.
When you look back on that experience, what do you think the lessons are that you have learned? How has it changed you as a teacher or as a person?
What we found
as well, is it was very, very difficult to report crimes.
You'd have children potentially alleging quite serious matters, and you'd go to the police, and the police first question was, is the child an EU national? And we'd say, well, no, obviously. And then the response was, not interested. So you'd have children trying to report rape, attempted murder, kidnapping. The police are not interested. And as a teacher, I really didn't know what to do about that. And I'm still not quite sure what I should have done. Because in the UK, if you've got a child protection issue or a social services issue, you've got a phone number, you ring someone and someone can do something. At Fanarameni, we had a very, very dubious situation of a local resident that would wander into the camp and take little boys off on his own and go missing for a long time with these children, then bring them back with loads of presents. Now, to my mind, that rings so many alarm bells, but I couldn't get anyone to take that seriously. In fact, we only finally got it resolved because I found a local Greek lawyer, and then the lawyer was able to take it up with the police and threaten all sorts of legal stuff if something wasn't done about it.
Something else we haven't really touched on is the trauma that the children had experienced. How was that felt in the classroom?
I think there's two very different issues that trauma gave rise to. On the one hand, because some of the children had come from very, very difficult backgrounds, there was a tendency amongst some of the aid workers to lower their expectations. So I was told several times that I shouldn't be teaching children to write, that they should be colouring in because they're too traumatised. And there was one crazy day where we had a group of teenagers actually doing algebra and getting it all correct. And someone wandered in and said they shouldn't be doing that, they should be colouring in. And actually, here were children making up for years of missed education. Some of those children had not been in school for 3 years. They were catching up, they were catching up quickly, and yet there were aid workers potentially, for very good reasons, potentially wanting to deny them that catch-up because of their trauma. Now, having said that, there were days when the children were very traumatised. The day we had thunder and they thought they were being attacked, we just had to stop lessons that day. Other days, children would come in and sometimes they'd be weeping. What could we do about that? Well, very little, because we had no one to refer children to. There were no kind of psychologists going to come in and do something. So we largely had to work through the trauma issues. When the children were traumatised, we'd sort of talk to them a little bit in the way that any school pastoral system would work. We would do what we could. Sometimes that would help the children. Sometimes we had to let it just play out a little bit because we could only do what we could do.
You talked about trauma. What about the general mental health and well-being of the children?
I think some of the children were extremely unwell, that had quite considerable mental health issues that weren't being picked up. We encountered, I'm thinking now of one young lady that was so depressed she wouldn't come out of her tent. And the other children came to us and said she's got the sadness sickness, that she wouldn't come out. And over a period of about 6 weeks, we enticed her out of the tent. We enticed her to the door of our tent, but she wouldn't come in. Then she came in, but she wouldn't sit down. Then she sat down, but she wouldn't get involved. And finally, after 6 weeks, she started getting involved in lessons. And actually, the lessons normalised her experiences and actually started to help her to recover. And I think one of the things that people don't reflect enough on in schools, in camps, is that they're often described as activities. So school is an activity for the children. And it's often equated with things like doing jigsaws or playing football, that they're all activities. But I think what is sometimes forgotten is that for children, school is their normal life. Providing school in a camp is normalising the children's experiences. And for children that have got mental health issues, and the issues are arising because of the lack of normality, then providing a school is an incredibly important part of helping them with their mental health issues.